From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week. Well, tourism is up. Skier days are up. Residential and commercial construction continues at a steady pace. So with all this growth, what kind of demand does it put on our ability to collect, convey, treat, and dispose of domestic wastewater? Joining us in the first part of the show to discuss this is Mike Lures. He is the general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. We'll talk about our existing wastewater collection and treatment infrastructure and what plans there might be for expansion. We'll also get an update from Mike on some unique research they have going on at the East Canyon facility. For the past 5 years or so, they've been looking into the presence and impact certain chemical compounds called endocrine disruptors are having on East Canyon Creek's water quality and its inhabitants. Chemicals found in pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, and soaps have the ability to mimic hormones and as a result impact the reproductive systems in fish and reptiles. We'll hear from Mike on the latest in this research. Then in the second half of the show, National Weather Service senior hydrologist Brian McInerney joins us to recap the past 3 months of weather and climate conditions locally and throughout the state. We'll discuss what this past spring was like in terms of temperature and precipitation and how our local watersheds are doing as we head into the summer. And with El Nino finally transitioning to a La Nina, we'll get his thoughts on how that might impact us as well. We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. And get started right after these messages from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
American Roots on KPCW is proudly supported by Donna Van Buren of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs in Park City, Canyons, and Deer Valley for 30 years. Greater Park City Properties can be reached at hoa@greaterparkcityproperties.com.
Cushman & Wakefield Commerce, a proud supporter of KPCW Radio, offers commercial real estate and brokerage assistance, tenant and landlord representation, property management and valuation services for companies and investors throughout the Intermountain West, online at comre.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week, and joining us in studio is our first guest is Mike Lures. He's the general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, and he's here to talk about some issues with respect to wastewater collection and treatment, some plans to expand treatment systems, and then a little later we'll talk about some interesting research they're doing on something called endocrine disruptors, chemical compounds that show up in a lot of our personal care products, including our pharmaceuticals, soaps, and other cosmetics, et cetera, real interesting things. And while I'm at it, make sure, Mike, that we talk a little bit about caffeine, too, because okay. That's a really interesting chemical compound, too, that's showing up in more and more wastewater. But anyway, Mike, thanks for joining us this morning. So let's talk about wastewater collection, sewage collection. You and I are in the business, and we prefer to call it domestic wastewater, right? That's a much more civil-sounding name to it. But right now, there are two treatment facilities. There's one in East Canyon Creek and one along Silver Creek.
That's correct.
The East Canyon Creek treatment facility has a capacity of 4 million gallons per day.
That's correct.
Right, and the Silver Creek has 2 million gallons per day. So one is planned for expansion. I'll get to that in a minute. But we'll talk about that capacity. Is there any time of the year where the treatment plant is actually handling 4 million gallons per day of wastewater?
Maybe a good place to start, Chris, is to understand how the wastewater actually gets to the treatment plants. And as part of our district, we operate a complete set of interconnected pipelines that extend from all the resorts all the way down to, say, Jeremy Ranch, where our East Canyon facility is located. And when you look at all these pipes, and there's some underground pumping stations associated with that. We operate in excess of 300 miles of pipelines, and we have around 7,000 manholes and 12 underground pumping stations. So all of that is necessary to collect the wastewater and deliver it to the treatment facilities. Now, our peak load, or you might say the period of the year in which the greatest amount of wastewater arrives at the treatment facilities, is the week between Christmas and New Year's, as you would expect. All the ski resorts are loaded up, people are visiting, the town's very busy, and it's not unusual for us to approach 4 million gallons a day during those periods of time. Now, as a result of growth, as you indicated, we expand these facilities based on the demand for anticipated growth, and we are currently expanding the Silver Creek facility from a 2 million gallon a day facility to 4 million gallons. Mm-hmm. And we're also upgrading the treatment to what we call advanced tertiary treatment, meaning it's some of the highest level of treatment that we can install. And that's to protect the local streams and our downstream reservoirs.
Okay. Let me say that. We'll get to a little bit of that in a minute, some of the details behind it. But you're handling, again, you're handling wastewater from all the resorts, all the residents in the area, all the businesses, the restaurants, all of that.
Yeah, our service area includes everything from Summit Park, including Promontory and Deer Valley.
Okay. So it's all coming to those two facilities.
That's correct.
And right now, the East Canyon Creek at 4 million gallons per day is in, you know, is okay as far as being able to handle and manage the variations in flow,
that's
like
right.
You suggest, during the course of the year. Right now, it's probably pretty low.
It is, and quite honestly, that's quite a challenge for us.
When because, it gets low.
Yeah, when it gets low, because you technically don't have enough, and we use it the term food, meaning the raw wastewater, to feed our organisms that consume the organic material and it's part of the treatment process. So it's a challenge for us to go from very high flows to very low flows, but we build that into our systems, and we design them accordingly so we're able to do that.
Right. Not that we want to suggest that everybody go out and start, you know, flushing their toilet or something, too, but that's not what you're looking for.
Right.
But right now you're at a low flow condition. But, all right, so let's talk about the planned expansion at the Silver Creek facility. Right now it's 2 million gallons per day.
Right.
So you've looked out. You see that, like we talked about, the growth anticipated, residential, commercial, et cetera, and you're saying that we need to double its size.
That's correct. The Silver Creek facility was originally built in 1985. Growth has taken place, so we need to expand the facility. As you indicated, we're going to go from 2 MGD or 2 million gallons a day to 4 million gallons a day, and that will give us a capacity to treat the anticipated growth on that side of the service area for the next 15, 20 years, and another, say, 12, 15 years, depending on the rate of growth. During that period of time, we'll need to expand the East Canyon facility as well.
Really?
Yes.
And so, there's talk about, say, Treasure Hill, hundreds of hotel rooms, perhaps, you know, another 100 or so condominiums. What kind of impact might that have on the treatment, on the existing treatment or planned treatment scheme?
You know, that's a very good question, and we spend a great deal of time planning and working with the county and city on anticipated projects so that we can have facilities in place at the time that the services needed to be delivered.
Right.
Now, our facilities take approximately 5 years from the day we start designing the facility to the day we can turn the on button and start the new facility. It takes 5 years to go through that process. Our Silver Creek facility, we just started construction. We went through almost 2 years of design. So we're starting a three-year period of time in which we'll be under construction, and we'll be through with that facility in late 2019 at a cost of almost $51 million.
Right.
And I guess the important point here is that new growth pays 100% of the cost of these facilities for new growth. So our impact fees are high because we're building these advanced systems and treatment technologies. And the impact fees that we collect pay for 100% of that of the cost of new growth. So when Treasurer or these other projects come online, they pay their share.
Okay, but you don't have the latitude to say, you know what, a large expansion is proposed. We don't have the capacity to handle that. Therefore, we don't have a vote. You don't. The Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation doesn't have a vote in whether or not a new commercial or residential development comes online based on capacity. You have to manage that. You have to anticipate that.
That's correct. We are a service provider,
right,
and we respond to approved growth. So as these projects are approved by the various planning agencies, we look into the future and determine when these projects will need to receive service, and we build accordingly.
Okay. So that's how you just have to constantly be looking out. Like you say, you look out 10, 20. You have master planning that may go out 30 years.
Well, we actually have a master plan that goes out to 2043. And you might say, well, how do you do that? Well, you know, you look at our service area, and based on current zoning, we're only 57% built out of the kind of total ceiling that you could potentially reach. So these projects are large, expensive projects, so we have to look at the financing of these projects, the timing, the technology that's needed, and it takes a great deal of effort to ensure that the service is available when needed.
Right. Because back in 1985, somebody looked out 30 years ahead and said, this is where we'll be at 2015. And you can go back and look at that and see how they did.
That's true. And when we build these projects, we are always looking to enhance the next expansion. So we leave space for new buildings that may be needed in the future. So our master plans are something that we manage very closely, and they enable us to plan accordingly.
Yeah. Like you say, it's 5 years from the time you decide, oh, we need this expansion to the switch is thrown and the treatment system is up and running. So, all right. I was speaking with Mike Lors. He is the general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. You're listening to This Green Earth. Mike, let's turn our attention now to this advanced treatment system and why it's necessary. This is not an inexpensive proposition, but there's a good reason to treat the wastewater to the degree that you plan on doing it. This advanced tertiary treatment system, what does that involve?
Okay, advanced tertiary treatment means that you take wastewater and you go through the normal treatment process, but then you take it further and you remove nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus to help protect the local environment. Here in the Park City, Snyderville Basin area, we have these very nice, small, pristine mountain streams.
Mm-hmm.
And these streams are fragile. They can't take a lot of pollution, if you want to look at it that way. So we have to treat the water to very high levels to protect, say, our native Bonneville cutthroat trout and other species of fish. So the treatment level is high to protect the fish, but there's something else going on here that you might need to know about, and that is we've all moved here, and in order for us to have drinking water, all of our local streams and springs have been tapped to provide us drinking water. The result is that the streams have very low flows in them during the critical summer months.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, there are times when the water in the creeks, especially below our treatment facilities, is virtually made up of 100% treated wastewater.
Really?
Yes. And the East Canyon Creek above our facility in Jeremy Ranch has been bone dry above us. So our treated wastewater is keeping the fish alive downstream. And
fish and reptiles and plant life,
the entire ecosystem. So the level of treatment, the advanced treatment that we talk about, is very expensive, but it's very necessary because we live in a mountain environment with very low stream flows. And I know Brian may talk about that here later on, but when we have these low snowpacks, the amount of water that seeps into our local streams during September and August and September is a real critical factor. And I'll talk a little bit more about that and how our pharmaceutical issue plays in with that.
Right.
But the other issue is downstream reservoirs. In the case of East Canyon Creek, it flows into East Canyon Reservoir.
Right.
And Silver Creek flows into Echo Reservoir. When wastewater containing high levels of nutrients enter these reservoirs, it promotes the growth of various algae. And one of those types of algae, which used to be called blue-green algae, which is really a cyanobacteria, can produce toxins that are very serious.
Right.
They can damage the liver. They can damage all types of organs in the body. And we saw this in Utah Lake about a year and a half ago when the cyanotoxins built up and, a dog drank water out of the lake and died.
The whole ecosystem in Utah Lake has changed because of agricultural runoff,
right.
A number of things.
But it's mainly been driven by nutrients.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excessive levels of nitrogen and phosphorus called eutrophication
that sets up.
So you got to limit the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus because, like you say, it can ultimately end up being back in our drinking water,
into
the raw water going into the treatment plant.
That's correct.
So where does this nitrogen and phosphorus end up then?
So the human waste contains a certain level of nutrients. When the wastewater enters the wastewater treatment plant, we capture a portion of phosphorus, as an example, within the living organisms that are eating the raw wastewater.
Yeah.
So now we have a good portion of the phosphorus contained within these microorganisms. We settle those organisms out, produce a solid material, and that removes it from the water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not quite through with the water at that point. We even want to reduce the nitrogen levels further.
Right.
So we use an alum compound, and we flocculate or settle out every little tiny bit of material that's left. And as a result, our nitrogen phosphorus levels are exceedingly low.
Parts per billion?
They're like 0.04 parts per million.
Yeah, okay.
Pretty doggone low. And that's much lower than you would typically see, in a lake. So at that point, we've captured the phosphorus, and we release the water into the environment after we disinfect it using ultraviolet light.
Right.
The ultraviolet light does not leave any type of toxic residue.
Right.
And it's very efficient and very clean. Go through a process like that.
Okay, and so this nitrogen and phosphorus, by and large, ends up in the sludge.
That's correct.
The sludge is managed and dewatered,
We use centrifuges to dewater.
And then what happens to the sludge?
Okay, so the end product kind of looks like a wet Play-Doh material.
Yeah.
It's not drippy. It's wet, but it's not something that the water would seep out of. Currently, we're trucking it to the Salt Lake landfill where they're putting it on top of the landfill to grow grass because it has these nutrients in it.
Sure.
It helps promote the growth of grass. However, we're going to be considering here in the next 2 months taking our solids to a new facility that will be built as part of a water reclamation facility down in the Salt Lake Valley. They're installing these large anaerobic digesters to take sewage sludge, food waste, dead carp out of Utah Lake.
No shortage of that.
Yeah, and they put all this organic material in these anaerobic digesters, and they'll be producing the three products. One will be methane gas.
Methane gas, all right.
That they can put back in the pipelines. Two, they'll be taking that methane gas and burning it in generators to produce electricity, green electricity.
Right.
Third, they will be producing a pelletized fertilizer for agricultural purposes.
Okay.
So the cost to us is actually less than it costs us to dispose of it there at the landfill.
Hmm.
And it's looks like a tremendous project. It's going to be a very large project.
Right.
They'll be taking a tremendous amount of food waste from the food manufacturers down in Salt Lake, like Greek yogurt, places like that.
Right.
And it all will come together and produce a very nice renewable resource facility.
Perfect. Oh, okay, so that's happening in you said a couple months.
That's correct.
All right, so we'll stay posted on that.
We'll be waiting for them to complete the facility, but we have contracts in hand to sign, and we'll be a part of that.
Okay, got a few more minutes.
Okay.
Kind of flying through this conversation already. It's fantastic. Mike Luhr is the general manager of Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. Now, let's talk about some of the research you've been doing with respect to endocrine disruptors, what these chemical compounds are, and how they're showing up at the treatment plant, and why treatment plants don't do a very good job at removing them. So first start with what endocrine disruptors are.
Within the human body and within any organism such as a brown trout or a Bonneville cutthroat trout living in East Canyon Creek, we have what's called the endocrine system. Our endocrine system is made up of the various glands that secrete compounds into our blood system that tell us who we are, basically. Males to grow, hair, females to grow breasts. Mm-hmm. They control how we behave. They control basically everything about us. And these endocrine organs or glands include, the adrenal, the pituitary, all those types of things that people know of. If a compound is introduced into the human body or mm-hmm. a fish that disrupts the endocrine system, we call it an endocrine disrupting compound.
Okay.
The work that we have been engaged in for the last 5 to 7 years includes looking at the impact of these compounds to the native fish population. Mm. And without getting into too many details, we can tell you that the natural and synthetic hormones, estrogens in particular in this case, can feminize the male fish in East Canyon Creek during the critical summer months when the stream flows are very low. And that gets back to the amount of water that we have in our local streams.
Right.
If the stream is made up of 100% treated wastewater, albeit advanced treated wastewater, these compounds still exist. And the reason for that is our treatment facilities and all treatment plants throughout the nation were never designed to remove these ultra-low levels of compounds.
So they're low level in concentration, but also is it a function of the nature of the chemical makeup of these compounds that bacteria have a hard time breaking them down?
Let's look at the active ingredient in birth control pills. It's a very large, tough molecule because it has to get through the human system to produce the effect that it's designed for.
Right.
So when it's released into the environment through urine, that's treated at the treatment facility, those compounds are not broken down by the bacteria in the treatment facility. And they get into the local creeks. Now, we're talking about parts per trillion.
Sure.
Tiny, tiny, tiny amounts, but they're exceedingly potent.
Right. Particularly if you're a larvae. If parts per trillion to us may not be a high concentration, but if you're a trout larvae or a frog larvae, parts per trillion means something.
It means something. And we have done a number of studies with the Division of Wildlife Resources, and if you take a male fish and they're exposed to estrogens, they can be feminized. And the first way you determine if this process is starting is to look for a protein in their blood that's used for egg production.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have these proteins that are used for egg production in the male fish, things are starting to happen.
And you're seeing this?
We have seen that when the estrogens reach 4 parts per trillion.
4 parts per trillion.
Yes.
That has a consequence.
Right. And this is on adult fish.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And real quick, these are coming from, like you say, synthetic estrogens, natural estrogens.
That's right.
And this is why, among other things, other reasons why we don't flush our pharmaceuticals down the toilet or otherwise get it into the wastewater stream. These are so many different chemical compounds, some of them, like we say, in personal care products.
Yeah, the takeaway is do not flush any expired or unused medicines. Just don't do it.
Okay.
We have these take-back days twice a year that Recycle Utah conducts along with a Rotary Club. You can also drop off unused and expired medicines at the sheriff's office or the police department. No questions asked. You just walk in the front door and they get a black box. Just drop them in there.
Right.
But do not flush them, because if you're flushing them, you might as well go out and just dump them in the creek, because that's what's going to happen to them.
It's just going to pass through. Okay. Last question. This is always what fascinates me, because I did a study in Florida on this. Caffeine. We are a caffeinated society, right? From morning, noon to night, we're drinking caffeine in forms of coffee, tea, sodas, energy drinks, etc. You're seeing more and more caffeine showing up in your wastewater influent, and that also the bacteria have trouble breaking down.
That's
caffeine,
correct.
Too.
We're wrapping up a study with Baylor University, and we've looked at a whole host of compounds, but two of them are caffeine and Prozac-type compounds.
Oh, really?
And we have found these compounds to bioaccumulate in all size organisms throughout the food chain for 10 miles below the treatment plant.
10 miles?
Yes, because these compounds are very resistant to breakdown. And at 13 miles below our treatment facility, we can still pick up concentrations of caffeine and Prozac-type compounds. So the question we have, which is unanswered, is what is a therapeutic dose of Prozac for a brown trout?
Right.
We have no idea. We have no idea.
To be determined, but it's showing up, and what affects caffeinated fish and frogs, or caffeine's going to have on fish and frogs, etc. In a study in Florida, we found caffeine in the groundwater, in shallow groundwater.
We had a sample location above our wastewater treatment facility, kind of as a test area, like contaminated water. We picked up metabolites of cocaine, caffeine, sweeteners, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. We thought it was a lab error.
Mm-hmm.
Then we realized that it was adjacent to an area that was served by septic tanks.
No kidding. And so upstream of your facility, you're seeing these compounds. And you know what, Mike? The septic tank issue, that's a whole nother story. And that's the county is trying to address those issues. But you think, your advanced treatment systems have hard time with pharmaceuticals, endocrine disruptors, caffeine. Septic tanks don't even bother. They have a hard time just managing the nitrogen and phosphorus levels. Fascinating stuff. We're all out of time, though, Mike.
Thank you.
Where can we go? The Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District website?
You can go to www.sbwrd.org or give us a call. We'll be glad to also give anyone a tour that would like to see the facilities and talk more about our research.
Yeah, and your research is posted on your website,
that's great.
I saw that.
We are still updating our website for the Baylor research, and that'll be out here in the next couple months.
Oh, perfect. All right. We'll have you back then and talk more about that latest findings.
Thank you, Chris.
Mike Lures, General Manager of Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. Thank you, as always, for taking the time to stop by. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Brian McInerney, Senior Hydrologist with the National Weather Service, joins us to talk all things, give us an update, weather, climate-related issues. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Assemble is proud to be a KPCW underwriter. Assemble offers executive offices which can be rented on a long or short-term basis, or a business lounge membership located in New Park. More information on the web at assembleparkcity.com or 435-709-7888.
The Vail Epic Promise Foundation is a proud supporter of KPCW. The foundation supports Vail Resorts employees in times of need and will help them pursue educational dreams. Information about the Epic Promise Foundation and what is available to Vail Resorts employees can be found at epicpromise.com.
Promontory, a private recreational community, is pleased to support KPCW. Custom home sites, mountain cabins, and golf villas offer golf and ski views with multi-generational club memberships. More information at promontoryclub.com or 333-CLUB.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service, and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Joining us in the studio is Brian McInerney. He is a senior hydrologist, the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City. He comes on every 3 months and every solstice and equinox. And hey, this is the solstice.
Yeah.
It's the summer solstice.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming up on it. The longest day of the year is right. Just a week or so. All right. So you come on and give us a little little summary of how the past season went with respect to temperatures and, more importantly, precipitation and what kind of impacts that has on our watershed. So let's start here. What would you say our spring was like in this area or in the state with respect to precipitation?
May was great. May was cold. May was wet. And depending where you are, you had up to 400% precipitation. We had the north aspect of the Uintas, and basically, to a lesser extent, the south aspect had about four times the normal amounts that they typically see. And that's really what you want when you have a low spring snowmelt runoff. We had upper elevation watersheds did better. They were about 75-80%, and that was due to the continued precip we had through the spring, and we didn't melt prematurely. The low elevation watersheds, though, they melted out really quick, and that was a direct result from February's warming and dry conditions through the early part of March, and they never really recovered because any precip they did get during that February-March timeframe came in the form of rain, and it just evaporated and it went away.
Right.
So if you look at Emigration Creek down in the Salt Lake Valley, they had forecast to about 30-40% inflow coming out of that area. But if you look up at Woodland and on the Provo and the Weber, they were maybe 85%, and that was a direct result. They didn't really lose snow during February, March. They had a slowdown, but then we had a very, very wet May that helped tremendously.
Right. And wet May in terms of snowfall or rainfall, does that matter?
A little bit of both. What you want is cold and wet. You want to delay the melt as long as possible.
Right.
And if you can do that, you get a much more efficient melt, because when you do melt the snow, you're in the time frame of late May, early June, and your temperatures can get up to 95 degrees like we saw in Salt Lake. So it melts all at once. It's like the sponge you're wringing out all at once. When we melt early, in March is what we typically have seen. You melt a little bit, and then it refreezes a little bit. You lose more. The plants come back early. Transpiration occurs, and you lose up to 50% of your spring snowmelt runoff into the air. And so you don't want that.
50% of runoff is evaporated or sublimated in some cases.
Before it even hits the stream. Because think of your snow lines are getting away far away from the stream itself. So when the snowpack melts, that water is in a very warm environment, and it typically evaporates. Or the plants come back early and they pull it up through their roots and transpire it out through their leaves. So you can lose a tremendous amount of water. What you want is to keep it as long as possible, have a really big snowpack, and then melt it all at once. You might cause some flooding, but what we've seen now, we didn't have any flooding at all, but we had some more efficient runoffs due to the cool and wet spring in May, and we had that last year. So that's helped out a great deal. Plus, people don't use their sprinklers. Farmers really don't use the stored water.
Okay.
So we're keeping it in the reservoir. So our
farmers,
reservoirs are doing better.
Yeah. Farmers are conscientious about their water use. I say that because at where I live in Raccoon Club Village, it was pouring rain last night. A little storm came through. And, of course, our sprinklers were on, too.
Yeah.
So their moisture detection system is sometimes based more on magical thinking than actual electronic devices. But that's a tangent there. But in any case, I also noticed that there's still some snow falling at 11, 12,000 feet in some of these cold storms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That's just kind of window dressing, really, at this point.
The
runoff comes in three parts. So you have the fall months, which you need as much rain as possible, and saturate the soil so you get rid of that pore space. Then you want the snow collection season to be normal or above. And we were doing that. We had a phenomenal winter up until February 1st, and then the high-pressure ridge set in again. that has been dogging us since the fall of 2011. And what that does, it shunts the weather north of us, and we don't see any storms for as long as that ridge is in place. And Stanford University has actually done studies on the ridge, the high-pressure ridge, and it's anomalous. It's getting bigger, and it's staying longer, which means we're getting drier and warmer.
We are.
Yeah.
And so, like Mike Loris was saying, and Mike is still here with us, and yep, feel free to join in on the conversation, that East Canyon Creek, for example, will be running dry, or typically runs dry, come Mike, right? But what time of the year do you think?
During the years in which we have low, you know, snowpacks, during August and September, the creek gets down to virtually nothing above our facilities.
So that's an ongoing trend you're seeing. That's going to become more of the norm, Brian. You think that given the trends in
we're trending to a drier hydrology over the long term. If you look at the models by NASA, really Mexico, the desert Southwest is becoming drier. And depending what we do with climate change, it's going to get incredibly dry, or it's just going to get dry. And even the best case scenario, it's going to be painful. But if we can put a lid on how fast we're burning fossil fuels and coal and things that warm our atmosphere, that'll depend on how dry we get. But we are tending toward a drier soil moisture over the long haul.
Just read an article this morning with respect to levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that right now concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is around 407 parts per million. You know, it goes up and down during the course of the year. But based on that level, that researchers believe that it may not fall below 400 parts per million. CO2 levels usually are at their lowest in fall, late fall, when there's kind of a lag there, but you have a lot of plant activity of taking up CO2, and the concentrations fall below 400 parts per million. Well, this may be the first year where it will not fall below 400. Well, even at its minimum, it'll still be above 400 parts per million. We know that Keeling curve is just a linear curve year over year of growth, of increased concentrations.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, though. We're not seeing much change in that.
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to the reservoir question, I also read that Lake Mead is at its all-time lowest level, somewhere it's at like 37% capacity. And Lake Powell is also very low, correct?
Yeah, 57%. Yeah.
So the idea of somebody sort of floating the idea of removing Glen Canyon Dam, drain Lake Powell, and to flow into Lake Mead, and if you combine the two, you would still not be at 100%.
Yeah.
That's how low the levels are. And there's a lot of evaporation that goes on in those reservoirs because they're just giant bathtubs out in the middle of the desert setting. Hundreds of billions of gallons of water lost to evaporation.
Yeah, if you look at the environment down there, it's very conducive to evaporation. It's incredibly hot. There's a lot of sunshine. And those reservoirs are just losing a lot of water during the year. And when you talk to the Bureau of Reclamation, Lake Powell may never fill again with the current regimes and what we have forecasted in the long term. Just because of equalization, when you have so much water in Lake Powell, it needs to be pushed down into Lake Mead. And as a result, we'll probably not see Lake Powell fill again.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And there's talk also of lowering the intake levels for the power plant there, because as water levels continue to go down.
Yeah, we thought at the beginning of the year with that very strong El Nino that we had a good chance of an above-average snowpack and runoff. And it was doing really well through December and January, and then the ridge set in for briefly, you know, for about 6 weeks, but it was enough to bring us back to below average runoff volumes.
All right, so let's turn our attention to that. Again, we're speaking with Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service, senior hydrologist there. So we had a record-breaking El Nino, I guess record-breaking in terms of its size or extent, and so the temperatures that were associated with sea surface temperatures, correct?
Yeah.
So this is a big one.
That was a big one.
Now it's transitioned away. It phases out like it's expected. Now it's turned to a La Nina.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What does that mean for us?
So So the equatorial Pacific, by Ecuador all the way to Australia and Indonesia, typically has a certain amount of heat and wind. And the wind pushes the surface temperatures that are warmer over by Australia. And that happens year after year for thousands of years. And it basically controls how the global climate goes, the global weather patterns. But occasionally what happens is the wind quits and that warm pool goes back toward Ecuador. That now has expanded this massive area of heat, of energy, of moisture into the atmosphere. And it changes where the stationary high and low pressures are. For El Nino, typically you get a flip-flop. Areas that are cold and wet get warm and dry. Areas that are warm and dry get cold and wet, like the desert southwest. Northern Utah, not so much because we're in the middle. So the signal is not very good. That's how it used to play out. But we've got a different atmosphere now. And we're not seeing those easy kind of projections because they're not handling it that way. If you talk to the scientists at the NOAA labs in Boulder, they'll say it doesn't behave like it used to, and they're on shaky ground as to what this means.
Because it's going to impact their models and their ability to look ahead with any type of
Because really, when you do any kind of modeling, what you do is you set up your model, and then you run it on data that you already know. And if it correlates, then you're in good shape to say it behaved this way in the past, now it's going to behave this way in the future. We have good confidence. We've changed the atmosphere. So the atmosphere we have today is different than what we had in 1950 to 1980. And so the behaviors of weather and these long-term weather trends are behaving much differently. And to get a handle on that, we can't go really beyond 7 days very well to say what's going to happen in 3 months from now. What's going to happen with this La Nina? La Nina, you typically get enhancement for what you already have. Pacific Northwest is cool and wet. It gets cooler and wetter. Desert Southwest is warm and dry. It gets warmer and drier. Well, that hasn't really worked out as well. 2011 was our last La Nina, and we had all sorts of river flooding and high runoff, and it didn't really correlate with what you typically see. So for us at the National Weather Service, we forecast out 7 days, and then we try and warn for any hazardous weather coming your way or runoff. Beyond that, that's where the people that do the long-term forecasting, and it hasn't worked out as well.
All right. I'll tell you what. I got to get a couple of underwriters in.
Okay.
Let's do that. And we'll come back. We'll continue this conversation, talk a little more about potentials for flash FUD. You always like to make people aware of that, those situations. And some information on temperatures and how temperatures have changed in our months of June over the last 6 decades. I've got it. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Renee from the Sprinkler Barn at Park City Nursery. Since 1983, Park City Nursery has turned on KPCW. Sprinkler turn-ons are available online at parkcitynursery.com through the beginning of June. We have water-wise sprinkler system installation, revisions, and parts. We know what grows.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
You've probably heard advice like, don't swallow gum, it stays in your intestines for 7 years. And drinking milk before you swim can cause you to cramp and drown. Or spicy foods give you ulcers. But if you're looking for more sound gastrointestinal advice, call Dr. Ega Bednarz. She can answer your questions, treat you with her outstanding skill, and she doesn't prescribe wives' tales. To make your appointment with the only GI doctor in Park City, call 435-658-7400. Park City Medical Center is a nonprofit community hospital and supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues. I'm Chris Cherniak. Now, Larson is away this week, and we're speaking with Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist at the National Weather Service, talking about all things weather and climate and temperature. Temperature-wise. Last week, this past Sunday, was the frost-free event at Summit Community Gardens, where this is typically on average the growing season officially starts. We're kind of out of the at least the potential for temperatures to fall below 32 degrees. And I was looking at some data out of Salt Lake City International Airport. They have the most robust set of data. We know we've talked about that in the past. And over the past six decades, the average June temperature has increased by 2.5 degrees. Okay, so that's the average daily temperature increase. But more importantly, average nighttime lows during the month of June have gone up by anybody? What would you say, Brian? Four degrees.
I'd say 4 degrees.
Yeah. 4 degrees warmer our Junes have gotten. And that's a big deal when it comes to ecosystems, watersheds, runoff, how plants respond to a warmer nighttime lows, transpiration. Everything is impacted. Yeah. Everything is affected by, in this case, 4 degrees. Julys are even somewhat warm. Nighttime lows in Julys are like 6 to 6.5 degrees warmer.
Yeah.
So our days get warmer, but more importantly, our nighttime lows are getting much, or seem to be pushing the trend along. Is that something you're seeing around the country too?
Yeah, if you look at the part of data that really stands out with a warming climate, it's the nighttime lows are not nearly as warm as they used to be. And when you think of the science of how it works, is during the day the sun shines, warms up the Earth's crust, warms up the atmosphere. Then at night, it re-radiates back out into space. So you have this balance mm-hmm. over time. Well, when you put a lot more greenhouse gases, nitrogen, or nitrous oxide,
carbon dioxide, methane.
You trap those that heat as it's leaving the atmosphere at night and re-radiates it back to the atmosphere as opposed to going out into space. And that was the signature when the scientists first started doing this research that they were looking for. And that's actually happened in a big way. And if you look at Salt Lake City's data right around the early 1980s, that's when we started this trend. And it's getting warmer all the time. And we continue to do so.
And speaking of methane, which is an even more potent, quote-unquote potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, Mike Lewis was talking about how the sludge that comes out of the wastewater treatment plant is going to go to anaerobic digesters down in the city, that facility, which is going to generate methane, but that methane is going to be captured and used as a source of energy. So otherwise, Mike, typically a lot of treatment plants might vent or flare off their methane or just vent their methane out of their digesters, yep. Right?
A wastewater treatment plant is typically a significant source of methane, and that's the other advantage of capturing it.
Right. To keep it from just going into the atmosphere and contributing to the greenhouse gas effect.
Methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas, but it doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long as CO2. CO2 stays in the atmosphere for about 1,000 years.
1,000, okay.
Yeah.
So what was generated back in the early parts of the Industrial Revolution are still, that carbon dioxide is still floating about.
Right. And methane is much more potent, but it
breaks down.
It goes about, I think, 40 years.
Right, okay. But that contribution, that effect results in our warming temperatures daytime, more importantly, our nighttime lows getting warmer. And that's around all four seasons, too.
Yeah.
Our winters are a little warmer. Our springs and our falls are a little warmer, too. Okay, so a few more minutes. You always like to talk about flash floods and bring some education and awareness there, particularly slot canyons and exposure there. You have a good relationship now with the National Park Service in alerting them of potential flash floods, right?
Right.
Okay.
So if you look back, it's September 14th last year. One thunderstorm complex killed 21 people in flash floods. The polygamous compound of Hilldale lost 11 people. Then we had 7 people who were canyoneering at Zion National Park get killed, and then there was a guy driving his car through a flooded wash who got killed that same. And it was all of the same thunderstorm complex. It was the largest loss of life, and we're seeing more intense thunderstorms. And that's going to pick up right around the start of July as we bring the monsoonal moisture up from the Pacific. So if you're going to go down to southern Utah, understand that the weather is really a big part of what's going on. If it's a clear day, high pressure, have a great time. Don't worry about it. But if you start seeing thunderstorms early in the morning, weather.gov has, and you click on Utah, we have a flash flood potential where you click on flash flood. You'll see today and tomorrow what the potential for flash flooding is based on the atmospheric conditions. That means you have more information to make a decision as opposed to just going down into a slot canyon. And once you rappel down in there, you can't get out until you finish the canyon. So it's
right.
really important that you know the weather, know the flash flood conditions before you go, because they're incredibly dangerous places once we start having thunderstorms.
If you were going, if you were planning on a trip into a slot canyon and there was a, let's say today, a 30% chance of thunderstorms, is that a percentage that makes you concerned enough that you would avoid slot canyons? Is there something you look for like
that? So typically, we try and stay away from percent of precipitation because you might just get drizzly rain
right.
all day. You're getting a raindrop on your head, which means it's a higher probability. What we look at is the potential for flash flooding, intense thunderstorms, where you get a deluge of rain on a very steep-walled canyon that doesn't have any infiltration or vegetation, and it just runs off and doesn't infiltrate. What I would look at is what type of thunderstorm activity we have. Does the atmosphere feel very moist? Is it very humid? Are you seeing thunderstorm buildup at about 11, 12 o'clock? If you are...
Like we had here yesterday.
Yeah, right. You
literally
see it,
around 11.
All you have to do is look around, and you think, this is not a good idea to go today. We categorize it, the flash flood potential, as low, moderate, high, and we also have a dry category, which means if it's dry, you're good to go. Low, you still have a potential for flash floods. Moderate, it's probable you're going to get a flash flood, and a high is it's expected.
Mm.
If you have anything in the moderate to high, you should really not go. If you have anything in the low, be really aware if you're where you're going, what's going on. And if it's dry, have a good time. Don't really sweat too much about it. But be aware of your conditions before you go out there. Don't take your family or friends, because we're losing people to fatalities in flash floods every year. Last year on that September 14th incident was the highest loss of life we've had in the continental U.S.
Really?
From a weather-related disaster.
Amazing.
And it happened right in our backyard.
Employ the precautionary principle.
Yeah.
And two things. When you're in a slot canyon, your apps or your radar, you know, your phone-based radar isn't going to work.
Yeah.
And if you see a thunderhead 5 or 10 or 15 miles away, that still means you're at risk, because you might be that slot canyon might be within the watershed.
Yeah, the thunderstorms that killed the people were forming in Arizona, and they stayed together and actually strengthened for a roughly about a 2-hour period. They usually last for about 20 minutes. It went for 2 hours, and by the time it hit Zion, it was raging. It was at the highest level we could see on the radar for potency for thunderstorms.
Wow. Okay. We're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
That, as always, Brian McInerney with the National Weather Service. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the invite.
We'll see you at the fall equinox.
There you go.
I'm finally getting those right. Fall is sometime in September. How about that?
Great.
Talk more about our summer, how our summer did. And Mike Lohr is general manager with the Summit Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. Again, thanks so much for coming in and chatting about all things wastewater treatment, one of my favorite subjects. And let's thank our sponsors. Oh, you know what? I got to get one more underwriter in. Sorry, I'll be right back. This is Green Earth.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
It's time to wrap things up here. As Brian and Mike chat, I'm going to thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Bachholt Landscape Architects, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and the Mountain Resort of Park City. Remember, you can always join us, like us on our Facebook page. That's KPCW, This Green Earth. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM in Park City, only in Park City.